I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday Friday. Baltimore State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby yesterday announced that a grand jury has indicted all six officers involved in the police custody death of Freddie Gray. In this hour, we'll hear from a University of Maryland law professor about the charges and how they might have changed from Mosby's original announcement earlier this month. We'll also talk about how the city's small business community is recovering from April's riots with Joanna Sullivan of the Baltimore Business Journal. And Reverend Kinji Scott of Park Heights tells us about a peaceful protest planned for tomorrow outside of City Hall to draw attention to Baltimore's surge of violent crime. That's all on Midday Friday after the news from NPR. And welcome to Midday Friday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. A busy show ahead in the next 2 hours. Got a lot of news to catch up on in this hour of the show. And in the second hour of the show, some light fare for you, including a chat with Stan the Fan Charles of Pressbox about the Orioles season so far. And also, we'll take a trek along the C&O Canal and the Potomac River with Mike High, a historian and author who's been up and down that trail numerous times and has some advice for us if we want to head out there with a bicycle or on foot or by kayak or do some camping along the C&O Canal and the Potomac this spring and summer. That's all ahead in the second hour of our show today. Baltimore State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby reported yesterday that all six officers charged in the police custody death of Freddie Gray have been indicted by a grand jury. The officers face a variety of charges ranging from misconduct in office to second-degree murder and involuntary manslaughter. There's been some change in the charges that the grand jury brought yesterday. We'll talk about that now with David Gray, law professor at the University of Maryland, Francis King Carey School of Law, who's been on our show before. David, it's nice to have you back on Midday.
Dan, thanks for having me.
Before we talk about the charges a little bit, I just want to ask you about the process, announcing charges on May 1st and then going to a grand jury. This is not an unusual thing for a district attorney or state's attorney?
Not unusual at all. And there are the original charges were filed in the district court, which is a court of limited jurisdiction and in particular doesn't have jurisdiction over the most serious homicide charges here. Those jurisdiction for those charges lies with the circuit court, which means that there had to be some way to get these charges from the district court into the circuit court. And one way to do that is by going in front of the grand jury and getting an indictment. So that's what this accomplishes, really, is to move the charges and therefore the case from the district court into the circuit court where it will ultimately be tried.
Okay, so nothing unusual there procedurally. Some people said back on May 1st, who was surprised at the announcement then of the charges by the state's attorney, that, what about the grand jury process? What about the autopsy? Shouldn't a grand jury see all this before you announce charges?
And so that Maryland criminal procedure is different from other states and jurisdictions insofar as the state's attorney doesn't have to, as a matter of the rules, go in front of the grand jury. But for these kinds of serious charges, it's pretty standard procedure and certainly not at all uncommon for her to decide to go in front of the grand jury and move from the district court to the circuit court via the grand jury.
P. Kenneth Burns of the WYPR news staff is with me in Studio A. Kenny Burns attended State's Attorney Mosby's press conference yesterday, press conference, but she didn't really take questions, did she?
She didn't take questions. She just read the statement, read the new old list of charges. There were a couple of revisions as she read them off, and then she walked out of the room.
This was held inside?
This was
at the state's attorney's office?
Yes.
Okay, very different from the atmosphere and the setting of the May 1st announcements.
No, the first announcement was held on the steps of the War Memorial, more than likely because of the glut of media there, not just the local media, but the national media as well.
I wanted to ask David Gray about this. There was an op-ed published in the Baltimore Sun earlier this week by two former federal prosecutors who were somewhat critical of the process here as presented by Ms. Mosby. Let me just read this to you, David. I was curious about your reaction to this. Announcing the charges against six police officers after a week of protests, Ms. Mosby appears to have been driven by the politics of the moment rather than the strength of the evidence, oddly proclaiming to the youth of the city that, quote, our time is now, end quote. Ms. Mosby's decision to subordinate her duty to do justice as a prosecutor to her role as a politician had two disastrous consequences. And then they go on to say one is alienating a police force comprised of many officers who serve with honor and integrity. And the second, the reputations and possibly the careers of several officers previously viewed as among the best of the city have been destroyed. So they say in this piece that going to the grand jury, Marilyn Mosby has an opportunity to get this right. I just wonder what do you think about the comment there regarding politics and criminal justice.
So there's no doubt that this is a high profile case, and State's Attorney Mosby is an elected official, and so in that respect, she is a political official in addition to being a professional prosecutor, and balancing those two roles is always very, very difficult. But one thing that's worth emphasizing is that none of us know what evidence her and her office have gathered in this case. And so the authors of the op-ed are not really in a position to suggest that there wasn't sufficient evidence to support these charges in the first instance or to support the indictments that have been handed down by the grand jury. That initial public appearance where State's Attorney Mosby presented the charges to the public, she was sometimes speaking as a professional prosecutor and sometimes speaking in her role as a political leader in the city. So, for example, she issued a call for peace during that presentation, and that was clearly something that she said as in her role as a politician, not in her role as a professional prosecutor. I think it's easy to take statements that she made during that appearance that she might have made in her role as a public servant and a political leader in the city and attribute them to her and her role as a prosecutor. But that would be a rather blunt reading of her public statement, I think.
Thank you, David. David, I want to talk about the changes in some of these charges here that might suggest to some people that this prosecutorial process, it was given more credibility by going to a grand jury because of changes that were made. Reckless endangerment charges were added against all six of the officers, while false imprisonment charges against three of them were removed. Your comments on that?
So the false imprisonment charges first, I think that it's fair to say those were charges that received a lot of criticism, both from defense attorneys and some skepticism from people like me, simply because there are a number of complexities around law enforcement officers' interpretations of the substantive criminal law when they make arrests. And the basic constitutional rule and the basic common law rule is that if officers make a reasonable mistake in effecting an arrest, that doesn't make it an illegal arrest. And so that had just become, quite frankly, a little bit of a sideshow. Mm-hmm. And so I think in terms of her role as a prosecutor, the right thing to do was to remove those charges, which may continue to raise a lot of concerns, and to focus on what the real issue here is. False imprisonment and police procedures of stop and frisk that led to the initial arrest are important issues for public policy, but a criminal trial, a criminal prosecution is not the right forum for exploring those public policy concerns. Her concern here is to bring her strongest evidence for the most straightforward charges to the jury. And so I think that's why we saw the false imprisonment charges taken away, because in the grand scheme for this criminal prosecution, they're a sideshow. Mr. Gray died. And that's the real thrust of this criminal prosecution, is to see whether these officers were criminally responsible for his death.
Kenny Burns.
David, they still had, there was still a reference to the illegal arrest. Three of them are facing a second count of misconduct in office. What do you make of that?
The misconduct in office charge is, along with the new reckless endangerment charges, these are really a number of embedded lesser and included charges that the the prosecutor has brought in order to provide the jury with a range of possible verdicts based on their assessment of the evidence when they come to trial. And in particular, the addition of the reckless endangerment charge is important because it doesn't require that the state's attorney prove any causal relationship between the officer's conduct and Mr. Gray's death. For all of the homicide charges, she would have to prove a causal relationship between their conduct or their failure to act and Mr. Gray's death. But these reckless endangerment charges, she doesn't have to prove that result or that cause. She only has to prove the conduct. And so that's an important lesser and included offense insofar as the jury can convict on those charges without ever having to find that the officers, by their conduct or failure to act, caused the death of Mr. Gray. And with respect to those the remaining charges on abuse of office, there are a number of different facts that could underlie those claims, and so she doesn't need to, as she did with the false imprisonment charge, make the claim that there was no probable cause to justify the arrest or no reasonable suspicion to justify the initial stop.
David Gray, I want to ask you this. We've heard this, it's almost a cliche. Any prosecutor can get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich. When you hear people make that glib comment, what do you say?
So the grand jury only hears from the prosecutor. And the rules of evidence that apply in trial don't apply in the grand jury. So, for example, hearsay evidence is allowed in front of the grand jury. It's not allowed in trial. So that means the grand jury frequently doesn't hear direct evidence from witnesses. They hear a statement of facts from a police officer or an investigator. And the defendant doesn't have an opportunity to cross-examine, and so the prosecutor also instructs the grand jury in terms of what it must find in order to pass a true bill. And so because the prosecutor has almost complete control over the grand jury process and the grand jury process is held in secret, a lot of people are critical and resort to that that old saw that you just mentioned, that any prosecutor can indict a ham sandwich. But the fact of the matter is that the grand jury also has independent investigatory power. So they can request other witnesses, they can request additional evidence, and refuse to indict if they don't have the benefit of that evidence, if they think it's important. And that was a feature of the grand jury that defense attorneys for the officers emphasized in expressing their preference for a grand jury process and their hope that the grand jury would take its duty seriously. So it's not always the case that it's that easy to get an indictment, and I think it's probably harder in high-profile cases such as these where grand jurors are likely to take a little bit more care and be a little bit more scrutinous of the charges that are brought. But nevertheless, it remains true that the prosecutor controls the whole process. And that in the end, the standard for indictment is simply one of probable cause, not beyond a reasonable doubt. And so just because we have an indictment doesn't mean that the prosecutor will necessarily be able to make her case in court.
And one last thing for today, David Gray, really appreciate you being on the show with us. There are still several steps ahead before we actually have a trial. What might those be?
So the first step is the arraignment, which will be the first appearance in circuit court, which is scheduled for the 2nd. And then after that, there will be a long period of pretrial motions. And I'm sure some of those motions will include motions to dismiss. So my valued colleague, Doug Colbert, pointed this out to me, that all of the current motions, including the motion to dismiss, were filed in the district court. And one of the consequences of moving this to the circuit court is that all of those motions are now moot. And so we'll have a new round of motions to dismiss. We'll probably see a motion for change of venue, and that all of that pretrial motion practice and discovery will happen over the course of the summer and the fall.
David Gray of the University of Maryland School of Law, thank you very much for the help today.
I appreciate being on your show. Thank you so much.
We turn now back to Kenny Burns of the WYPR news staff, who, in addition to attending the press conference or the announcement yesterday by State's Attorney Mosby of the indictments returned by the grand jury, also went to a press conference held by Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake on Wednesday or Thursday.
It was Thursday.
Thursday. And this regarded, the mayor has declared a goal, or she did when she was first inaugurated, of attracting 10,000 families to Baltimore City, growing the city's population. And a lot of people looking at events of recent weeks and days with the surge in violence in Baltimore City, wondering whether that could ever happen. So I guess there was some new information about population trends in Baltimore, right?
Well, the numbers are not bad. They're not good. But there is some positive news out of this. It's like at least the current estimate from the U.S. Census Bureau, a slight bump in the population, 0.3%. We're hovering just under or just more than 622,000 people. Downtown and Harbor East definitely seen the boom with all the residential developments. You have mostly close-knit greater communities in East Baltimore that have really seen the decrease. And it looked at other factors, why people choose to leave the city. And by the way, Towson is leading the charge with taking a number of residents that choose to leave Baltimore City when they move to Baltimore County. Also looked at why people, why they stay in their communities if they do buy another house. Things like that. And also looked at what really triggered these migration patterns. And a lot of it is life events, entering college, getting married, retiring. And so they took this the last 18 months to study the migration patterns of those who lived or formerly lived in Baltimore City.
And what do they see, especially among millennials, because that seems to be a group that gets a lot of attention?
Millennials are leading the charge back to the city. And I did a similar story last year. They're looking for some places that are walkable. They could walk to work. They could walk to the shop. They don't necessarily want to have a car. They want to use public transportation and use a bicycle to get around.
What did the mayor say in response to questions about the recent unrest, the riots of April 27th, the surge in violence?
She's being positive. She was encouraged by those right after the unrest. They decided to help, not even being asked to. They just jumped out with a broom or asked, "Where do you need me?"
Mm-hmm. Here's what more of what the mayor had to say at her press conference this week.
It is extremely frustrating when you take a look at how far we've come when it comes to reducing shootings and homicides that we're experiencing in this spike right now. It is disheartening, but my resolve is not. I am still resolved to continue to reduce violent crime in our city. We know that we've had spikes before, and we've been able to get on top of those and push the violent crime down, and I'm confident that we're going to be able to do it again. I think when we have a spike, it gets everyone's attention on the issue, and unfortunately, when we're able to pull, bring those numbers down, it's not front of mind. We've had spikes before. We've gotten over them, and we're going to do it again.
Homicides across the city are up nearly 40% from last year. Baltimore saw 34 murders in a recent 30-day period, in a surge that has residents asking what can be done to quell violence and questioning police practices. The police department is reporting 100 homicides compared with 71 at this time last year. Last year, the city reached 100 homicides in early July. Non-fatal shootings are up more than 70%. With at least 19 people shot earlier this week, Tuesday, Wednesday. We don't have the numbers from Thursday or Friday. We'll try to update those for you. We're going to talk some more about the violence in Baltimore, the surge in the city, and a march that's coming up this weekend, an actual anti-violence march that's going to City Hall. So we'll be talking about that in a few minutes. Thank you, Kenny Burns.
Thank you.
Pete Kenneth Burns of the WYPR News staff. We have to take our first break here on Midday Friday. When we come back, Joanna Sullivan, editor-in-chief of the Baltimore Business Journal, joins us for Midday's weekly business report, how businesses are recovering after last month's riot and unrest, and how can the city bridge the gap between its rich and poor neighborhoods. We'll talk about the BBJ's cover story this week with Joanna Sullivan after this. Welcome back to Midday Friday. 410-662-8780 is our phone number. We have live open phones if you want to join our conversation today about what's going on in Baltimore City, what has been going on this past week. From the 10 p.m. curfew during the state of emergency to several Orioles games that had to be moved out of town, Baltimore's business community is struggling to make up for lost profits from last month's riot and unrest, not to mention the struggle to rebuild and reopen for those stores that were damaged or looted during the rioting, mostly in West Baltimore. We're joined now by Joanna Sullivan, editor-in-chief at the Baltimore Business Journal for the weekly Midday Business Report. Nice to see you again, Joanna.
Thanks for having me.
You had a cover story last week on connecting Baltimore's downtown with West Baltimore. You follow up this week with what angle? The second part of that cover story series.
The second part, we asked community leaders to talk about how do you bridge the gap between the two Baltimores. And we got a range of answers, some very practical, like we need to put more focus on vocational education. We heard from Wayne Frazier, who's with the Minority Maryland, Washington, D.C. Minority Contractors Association. We heard from Don Fry, who talked about, you know, a lot of
Greater Baltimore Committee.
Yes, of the Greater Baltimore Committee. We heard from Dr. Jay Perman from University of Maryland, Baltimore. So we had a lot of great answers. And, you know, people are still trying to figure this out. No one person has the answer, but everyone seems to want to start talking.
Do some of these folks admit either on or off the record that this has not been top of mind until now?
Yes, and that's some people do admit that, why are we talking about this now? Why haven't we been talking about it for a long time? We knew all these problems existed.
I talked to someone who runs a restaurant, a business in Baltimore, and said, you know, we have to now make up for 50 years of neglect, of not paying attention to these issues. That's why I ask you that question. Now, how are businesses on the ground, those that were actually damaged or affected in some way by the unrest, how are they faring? Do you have a read on that yet?
I think everyone is still hurting, you know, even if they weren't hit, they're hurting from the losses. You know, people lost wages during the curfew. And then you have the businesses who were actually looted, and there's a mix. Some people had insurance and they're fixing up. I was in Mount Vernon the other day and saw, you know, Ted's Music fix their window,
right,
and some of the other. I went to go eat at Trinacria Cafe, and, you know, they still look like they had some damage repair, but, you know, they were serving lunch. It was pretty busy. So it's, you know, people are slowly recovering. Some don't have the money, you know, to open back up. So, you know, the Baltimore Development Corp is trying to raise money to help them with loans. There's a lot of, you know, opportunities with SBA, the Small Business Administration,
and the state too, right?
And the state.
The state has offered some short-term, low-interest loans too, emergency loans.
So there's a lot of options. It's just a matter of, you know, some people don't know where to turn. They might not be on a computer, so they're not sure how to, you know, look that information up. So getting the word out is going to be key.
Now, following the unrest, we have this surge in violence, and we've had surges in violence before. Baltimore, you know, the FBI reports every year that we remain per capita one of the most violent cities in the country. And that news comes and goes, surges come and go. But here, following the unrest, the death of Freddie Gray, and the riot that followed that, and all, and what's going on between the community and the police, it all looks interrelated, which is, you know, troubling on another scale altogether.
I think it's, you know, you're seeing it downtown. It just doesn't feel as busy. I mean, this week, you know, you had Orioles games. There's not as many people downtown. And I hear anecdotally people say, I'm not coming in.
Yeah, you know? I've heard that from people, too, who say they won't be coming to Baltimore for a while. Although the Preakness did pretty well. The Preakness drew a record crowd of 131,000 people last Saturday. So there's that.
That was a highlight. That was, you know, terrific, and proof that why we need to keep the Preakness in Baltimore. You know, those people stayed in hotels. They ate at restaurants. They bought things to, you know.
As good as that was, Joanna, we also had the general manager of the Maryland Jockey Club, who runs Pimlico, talking about moving the Preakness out of Baltimore. So as good a day that was, with the $85 million betting handle at Preakness, we had Sal Sinatra saying, you know, we might have to move this to Laurel, the Stronach Group.
You know, the timing couldn't have been worse, but I guess it was probably planned. And it's, you know, sad. People are talking about, how do we keep it? you know, and also, is that conversation too late? I mean, and there's a lot of people hoping for, you know, a savior. Put it on Port Covington is what they're saying. You know,
you mean the development of Port Covington?
Yeah, build a new track. Keep it in the city.
Well, you got Kevin Plank, who's working on Port Covington now and is very involved in the Maryland horse industry. The cover story of the Baltimore Business Journal, it says a call for leadership, which is the second part of your two-part series on West Baltimore and downtown, specifically in the wake of the unrest. So a call for leadership. Who is that on the cover, though?
This is Diane Bell McCoy, who is the CEO of Associated Black Charities. And I spoke to Diane last week and said, you know, would you help us with this story? Will you pose for a picture? And she said, sure, you know. And she talked about how for so long, you know, she's been driving through West Baltimore. She lives in Ten Hills and on her way to work, and how it makes her cry that, you know, things have gotten so bad. And, you know, she is calling for a really frank discussion. She's like, we have to stop, you know, not talking about it.
Joanna Sullivan from the Baltimore Business Journal, thanks for being with us today. The print edition of the BBJ is out again with this cover story. We're talking about a lot of other stories that the BBJ covers all week long with their busy staff over there. Thank you, Joanna.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And we want to welcome back to the show now Reverend Kinji Scott, who was with us before a couple of weeks ago, a Baptist minister, a community activist from Park Heights, who's organized a march and protest this weekend in response not only to Freddie Gray's death, but this has to do with the, I'm not going to even call it an uptick. I don't like that word. This is a serious surge in violent crime in Baltimore. I'll just repeat these numbers again. Homicides up 40% over last year, Kinji Scott. 34 murders in a 30-day period, recent 30-day period. 100 homicides already this year. We didn't reach that point until July last year. Non-fatal shootings up some 70%. I want to listen to a couple of statements made by the police commissioner of Baltimore. First of all, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You know, Police Commissioner Batts had some comments about this today, earlier this week, Anthony Batts. Let's listen to what he had to say to reporters.
Officers tell me and their supervisors anytime in a Western, when officers pull up to respond to a call, they have 30 to 50 people surrounding them at any given point in time. We have to send out multiple units at any time. They're just doing basic police work in a Western right now, which says that we have to work on that community engagement. In addition, it makes it very difficult for us to follow up on violence that takes place there. If you have 50 or 60 people, it makes it difficult to get eyewitness. It makes it difficult to get information that is out there. Officers are talking about as they respond out there, you have many citizens with handheld cameras that they're sticking in the faces of the officers, about an inch off the officer's face. They've been surrounded. And so we're having to respond a multitude of resources over there, but we don't want to respond too much that we cause a bigger issue, but we do want to make sure that the officers are safe and that the community are safe.
All right, that's Police Commissioner Anthony Batts making a reference to the Western, meaning the Western Police District, where he says a lot of this violence is occurring. Here's another statement from the commissioner.
I think it's a time of uncertainty within the organization. What I can tell you is my big concern, there's a lot of officers who are engaging. We're getting guns off the street still. We're making very good arrests. We're doing searches and seizures. So throughout the city, the organization is doing well. What I have a concern about in talking to officers is the epicenter of the rioting, which is the Western District. We've had 19 homicides there for this year and 51 shootings in that one area. And that outpaces all our other districts dramatically.
Okay, Anthony Batts, the police commissioner of Baltimore. Kinji Scott, what are your thoughts about what the commissioner had to say in terms of police having difficulty carrying out their duties with crowds of people around, with cameras, cell phone cameras?
My problem with the commissioner's statements is that he has, for the last 2.5 years, provided a lot of on-spot excuses for the failure of Baltimore City Police Department to do certain things, specifically community engagement. I think I know for the last 2 years and for 81 days straight, I emailed him, and we had a conversation about, look, man, when are you going to get our communities, when are we going to get a community engagement plan that's non-punitive so that we can build public trust in our community? And this was before the death of Freddie Gray. You know,
what brought you to that? Why were you communicating with him on that, with that theme?
Because I understood that that Baltimore City has had a history, of a bad relationship as it relates to the black community, specifically in a Baltimore City police department.
So it's just a general problem with that, not a specific thing that set you off on that path.
Yeah, well, it did. One of the big things that set me off on that path was the fact that we were still having issues with police brutality, but was also having issues when we hear the mayor and she's somewhat dismissive and say that people are not concerned when the numbers are low. But let's be quite frank. I mean, when in 2013, we had 236 murders. In 2011, we had 2014. Those are still pretty high numbers. And some of us have been saying, look, we need to do something to reduce crime. And that was one of the reasons I was talking about community engagement. I say, hey, man, let's get some folk on the ground. Let's get some police officers in our community so that we can establish those relationships so people will feel comfortable having a conversation with police officers in their community. And it never happened.
Did you get to talk to the commissioner? You said you actually had a conversation with him about it?
I did have a conversation with the commissioner about this at a public safety hearing. And what he told me, you know, when he referred to the community as being racist, he said basically the same thing about Baltimore City Police Department. He said, well, it's difficult to implement a community and policing, a community engagement plan when we're working on policies that are from the 1920s. And what I reminded him, I said, you know, we had less police cars in the 1920s, and most of our police officers on foot. So
was he referring to how segregated he found the city?
He was referring to,
he had made that statement C-SPAN. He had made somewhere else.
He was referring to how segregated the city was. But even in that note, most cities, to a certain extent, people live with people who they want to live with. It has absolutely nothing to do with segregation. That's just my opinion. But that has absolutely nothing to do with the bad relationship that exists between the black community and the police department.
If that relationship were better, and we're speaking in generalities in here, but if you went street by street, block by block, and that relationship was better, people would be more cooperative in helping the police solve crimes, prevent crimes?
Yeah, I mean,
is that what you're saying? I don't want to put words in your mouth.
No, that's exactly what I'm saying. I live in Park Heights. I live down the street from Plymaco Racetrack. I live off of Belvedere Avenue between Park Heights and Reisterstown Road. I live in a high-impacted area. I live around the corner from Garrison, where I know over the last 4 or 5 months, 10 people have been murdered around the corner from me. Right at Edgecombe, we were doing the Preakness, a person was murdered. So I live in those communities, and I know for a fact we're not happy with the crime in our community. We want the police to address those issues in our community. We're not happy that drugs are on our streets, but we can't have a conversation with a police department that is hostile toward us, and a police cannot have a conversation with a community that's hostile toward it. So we have to find a way to work together and stop the blame game, because it's not helping anybody.
I noticed from speaking with you and seeing your comments on social media that you're really impatient with people who say there isn't enough outrage in the community over black deaths black people who are killed in Baltimore City.
Yeah, I am outraged, because there is. Every time a mother buries her son, she's outraged. Every time a son buries his father, he's outraged.
But you've heard people say, well, that we've got demonstrations in the street, we have protests over the death of Freddie Gray. That may be justifiable, but where are the same protesters, demonstrators, when we have homicides
and
surges of violence?
And that's why we're marching and protesting tomorrow, because we are fed up with the violence overall in Baltimore City. It's not just about, we have 100 murders. And unfortunately, we have one young man, Freddie Gray, who was murdered by 6 Baltimore City police officers. But we have 99 other...
Allegedly. All right.
Okay.
He died in their custody.
Well, you know my position.
All right. Okay. All right. I just want to remind you what the charges say.
Yeah. Okay. But we have 99 other people who did not die at the hands of Baltimore City police officers. And so we have to be equally concerned about those 99. We should be equally outraged at the fact that 99 people in Baltimore City have been murdered. 87 to 88% of those people are African American. And we should be outraged to the point that in every city, in every neighborhood, every community leader, we can have community leaders saying that, well, we expect black people to kill each other. We heard that this week. We can't have a mayor saying that, you know, we only hear about it when we have these spikes in crimes. Well, we've been having spikes in crimes for the last 5 years.
Kinji Scott, Reverend Kinji Scott, is our guest in this segment of Midday Friday. You're welcome to join us. Comments or questions are welcome at 410-662-8780. An opportunity to talk about the surge in violence in Baltimore City. And also when we get back, we'll hear about the march that Kinji Scott and others are planning for tomorrow on City Hall, an anti-violence march, and also a pro-police march that we just found out about in the last 24 hours. More on that when we get back. This is Midday Friday. Again, our number, 410-662-8780. Welcome back to Midday Friday. Dan Rodericks here. You can join us for open phones now, 410-662-8780. 80, the Reverend Kinji Scott with me in the studio. I didn't get your reaction to the indictments of the police officers.
I have to be real honest. I'm happy. I mean, this is the first time in Baltimore City, or in any city, but specifically in Baltimore City, where we have police officers that were indicted for having a person to die in custody of the Baltimore City police officers.
Tomorrow you're having a march at City Hall, or to City Hall. Mm-hmm. Tell us about it. What's the route of it, and what's I keep calling it anti-violence.
It is anti-violence.
Keeping with your theme this week.
It is anti-violence. We're leaving from the same corner that the Freddie Gray marches started at Mount and Presbury, and we're marching south on Fulton to West Baltimore Street, and then east on East Baltimore to Baltimore and Holiday, and on to City Hall. And what's great about this march and this protest? It was started by Ms. Kiana Gray, who is a young lady who actually filmed. Kiana Mack.
She's the one that had that cell phone video of Freddie Gray's arrest.
Yeah, she's the one in the background, and it was her who came. I was already upset and just really upset about the surge in violence and what we were seeing in the paper with people dying and being murdered. And she came up with the idea. She said, look, let's do a protest against violence. She said, we have more people being killed by people in our community than we have people being killed by the police. And I said, hey, that's a great idea. And I said, you know, it's in line with what I wanted to do. And we jumped right on it.
Okay, so that, you're starting at 2 p.m. tomorrow at Presbury and Mount, hoping to end up at City Hall around 3 o'clock.
Yes.
So about an hour long march and then assembly at City Hall. Now, another group called Stand Up for Baltimore City Police has a Facebook invitation page, March for BPD, it says, for Baltimore Police Department, May 30th. Wait a minute, that's next week.
It's next week?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so these are a week apart. They're not the same day.
Week. Okay.
Okay. Wonderful. So I thought they were, you guys would be there on the same day.
Oh, no, that's good. Then we're glad. Good.
What, you don't want to be there at the same time?
Well, we didn't want to be there at the same time, you know, no, because we know that would have been conflictual, and we don't want that. We want to really have a protest to really speak out against violence in our community, and we don't want to really have that overlapping that.
Okay, so I have to make a correction on the air. I think we tweeted out the information that these were both on the same day. The BPD march is May 30th at noon and should end at City Hall. And I'm not sure of the route of that one. That's put out. That's presented by a group called Stand Up for Baltimore City Police. But Kinji Scott's march, along with Kiona Mack. I mean, do you have a name for your group or anything?
No.
You're just doing this.
It's a citywide protest against violence. You know, we are really upset with the violence. We're upset with the police response to it. And we are upset with the violence in our community.
Well, what do you think about the commissioner's statement that officers are having a tougher time doing their job now because all eyes are on them, and that they need more backup and support because of people in the street, some with cell phone cameras when they're trying to do their police work. Well, you heard him say that. So.
I did hear him say that. But then we have to also ask the commissioner, where has he been the last 2 weeks in the face of all this violence? Because let's be quite honest, we haven't seen a commissioner until a couple of days ago. So then he comes out of hiding after 2 weeks to tell us that the police are concerned about people being in their face. Well, you ought to, if you work on community engagement, then the police should feel comfortable with people being present if they're doing their job right. Matter of fact, if I was a police officer in this particular climate, I would want people there with their cameras out because I want you to capture me doing the right thing at the right time, regardless to who the person I'm arresting.
Do you have any idea why there's a surge in violence?
I don't.
Do you have any sense of what that's about? You know, we read in The Sun, you know, about someone being shot in the leg, somebody else being shot in the head, being killed. They're not all fatal. But you just wonder, well, like, what's going on? Some are on the east side, some on the west side. There's four or five in a row within a short period of time. I know you're not a police officer or detective, but do you have any sense what this is about? Are people settling scores because they think the police are standing back?
What we saw in Sandtown this last month or so was unrest, and what we saw in Sandtown was a lot of social unrest, and we saw people who were a part of a movement or an uprising because they had been castigated and disenfranchised. And that's one side of it, is that people are frustrated with not having jobs, with not having appropriate housing and education. But there are some other elements in our community that we do not always talk about. We don't talk about the fact that in that particular community, in communities like Park Heights, they are a ground zero for lead paint poisoning among our young people. We don't look at the side effects of that. We don't discuss the social elements of substance abuse or generational drug use in Baltimore, and the fact that many of our young people, and even people my age, were born into families where parents were addicted to drugs and they grew up in those situations. And so we have a lot of social nuances that have not been dealt with, specifically in the black community. And I believe in my heart that's what we're seeing now. Even if we go back a few years ago and we looked at the high number of children who were in foster care, if we have 5,000 kids in foster care on any given year, that's a whole lot of kids that are out of home placement without families.
Number has come down, though.
They have come down.
There's some progress there.
They have, but the thing is, Dan, when they came down, let's say 2006, if you got a kid, 7,000, I think, in 2006, now, those numbers may have come down, but what happened to those young people? Did they go back home? And so in 2006, that's what, 10 years ago, 9 years ago, kid grew up in foster care at 15, he's 21 now.
And so, I'm not diminishing what you're saying.
Yeah,
I'm just noting some progress.
Oh, no.
Because we have talked about these things.
I know. I am noting the progress, but what I'm saying is the lasting impact. What you do is you have kids who are still aging out. And when you age out, that doesn't, just because the numbers go down, it doesn't speak to the progress in that particular individual life. And those are the things that we have to really get in our communities and deal with. You know, is there a quick, easy answer, man? No, there's not a quick, easy answer to this. But we have to go beyond the rhetoric and be willing to implement programs and services in our community that deals with those issues that have been unaddressed.
Kinji, let's take a couple of calls from our listeners here on the Midday Friday Show. 410-662-8780. This is Mike in Dundalk. Mike, welcome to the show.
Hey, Dan. Thanks for taking my call. I'm actually driving through the tunnel on 895 right now, so forgive the noise. What I was calling to say was, first of all, I completely agree with the Reverend. I think we need to face facts here, too, that this is really about income inequality. I can tell you from living in Baltimore my whole life, you get one set of justice if you've got money, and you get another set of justice if you don't. I don't come from money. The other day, somebody pulled a gun on me. This was on Monday. They pointed a gun at me in front of witnesses, broad daylight. I gave an exact description of the person to the police. The police did absolutely nothing. This is only the latest and greatest in terms of gun violence that I've experienced in this city. I've had my car shot. I've had my house shot. I've literally dodged bullets. And the police have been absolutely useless to me. And I just wanted, my comment would be, I think it's time for the mayor to resign, and I think it's time for the chief of police to resign, and I think it's time for the affluent community in Baltimore to take a hard look at themselves and realize that they've got blood on their hands too, and they've got to stop ignoring the problem that they're, that's all around them.
Hey, Mike, before you go, just a couple of questions for me.
Sure.
I'm very curious about your story. So you were mugged at gunpoint on Monday.
I wasn't mugged. Basically, a gentleman pointed a gun at me for no reason, just literally just produced a .45 or maybe it was a 9mm automatic handgun.
Where did this happen, Mike?
My office is on Hollabird Avenue, and I'm on the city line between the city and Dundalk. I'm actually technically in the city, it was basically in a parking lot.
Okay, so someone pulled a gun on you, and nothing happened after that? He just walked away?
Pointed a gun at me, laughed about pointing a gun at me. I guess he thought it was funny.
He took off
in his car.
Okay, you reported this to police?
Yes, with a license plate number, an exact make of the car, an exact description of the gentleman who did it. I don't know why I'm calling him a gentleman.
All right, just another one more question.
Yeah.
You say that the police were indifferent or couldn't be bothered.
The 911 dispatcher seemed to be completely indifferent. I was told I would get a call back and I would be told, you know, what had happened. Nothing ever happened. Meanwhile, there's a guy running around out there who pointed a gun at me, and for all I know, he's driving back and forth past my office every day.
Hold on, Mike. We're short of time. You had no follow up on this from the police.
None. In a week, none.
That is not uncommon.
Mike, thank you. What did you say?
That's not uncommon with Baltimore City Police Department. I mean, there have been situations where I've had to call the police. Instead of the police coming, they call. So that is actually not uncommon. I spoke to a lady the other day who was a victim of domestic abuse about 3 years ago. She said she called the police and the police came to her house, spoke to her boyfriend, and escorted her out the house and told her she would have to go to jail. Unfortunately, that's a trend with Baltimore City Police Department. There's a culture of bad policing that we really have to deal with. And it's not all police, because I know police officers who do their job and do their job well. But we do have some issues that we definitely have to deal with.
John in Baltimore, our next caller. Go right ahead, John.
And I'd like to know, has anybody ever done anything about that poor little 3-year-old girl that ever find the perp that killed her on Old York Road? I mean, where were all the protests for that? Notwithstanding Freddie Gray, why didn't people get as crazy up in arms over the death of a poor little beautiful girl versus, unfortunately he died, but I didn't see any protests when this girl died, did you?
Mackenzie Elliott, actually, there was a lot of attention given to that at the time, and then some time went by and no arrests were made, although the police commissioner had pledged to, you know, get an arrest there.
Actually, he did. Remember, he arrested this guy and accused the guy of committing a murder, and then that was to kind of quell the public down, and then had the guy locked up for 2 months, and he did. But even though we didn't hear it in public, while I was protesting, and I'm HIV positive, for 81 days I went without my medication, begging the police commissioner to make an arrest with Mackenzie Elliott, and at the same time implement a community engagement plan. So many of us have been behind the scenes. We may not have been in the press, but many of us have been pushing for an arrest and raising a question: how could you arrest a guy and let the community think for 2 months you had the right guy, and you never made any statement until after the family started pressing the issues where you had to release the guy to say we're going in a different direction until this day, and we celebrate her 4th birthday this month, and we still have no clue. And their acts, and a lot of that's the community too. Now, we know I'm not going to just shift the blame in the lap of the police. The police commissioner says a lot of stuff he shouldn't. But as a community, we have to be responsible. There's no way in the world that somebody in that community is not aware of who killed that baby. And so if you can sit cowardly in your community and raise hell with the police when somebody get killed, but you can't say anything about the death of a baby?
A three-year-old baby.
It outrages me.
No, good point. The city council, members of the city council and the police department just recently summoned the press to call again for help in solving that crime.
Yeah. So when we can start talking about crimes in our community, and I agree, I've been a part of organizing police rallies, but at the same time, I'm equally as frustrated about what happened to little Mackenzie, and not only that, all those other unsolved murders in our city.
If you want to take part in this march on City Hall tomorrow against violence in Baltimore City, this surge that we're experiencing, starts at 2 p.m. at Pressbury and Mount Street in West Baltimore, heads down Fulton Avenue onto Baltimore Street over to City Hall. Kinji Scott, his Facebook page has more information about that. Thank you for being on the show, Kinji.
Thank you.
And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. We'll take a short break here for some Joe's Squared Pizza and for some lunch, and then we'll have the second hour of our show. So please stay tuned for the second half of Midday Friday.